Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Pike's Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV, and we will talk to everyone behind the camera, and I'll provide you with the guests and the information that you're going to want to have with your filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. My guest today is Deborah Granick. She's the Academy Award nominated director for Winter's Bone, and she's going to be talking about her new documentary, Stray Dog. We're going to talk to her in just a moment. She's also going to be a guest, an honored guest, at the Milwaukee Film Festival, which begins Thursday, the 27th of September, and runs until October 9th in the Milwaukee area. So if you're listening in this area or anywhere and can travel to Milwaukee, you're going to want to participate. You're going to want to see Stray Dog. You're going to want to also, she is conducting a panel in a symposium or workshop on directors working with actors. So you're going to want to be sure to tune in you're tuned in. You're going to want to join us at the Milwaukee Film Festival. She's going to be coming up in just a second. Let me say that the chat room is open. If you're listening live, all of these interviews are available at rexsykes.com. That's my name. I'm your host. Or you can find the information at rexsykesmoviebeat.me. That's the blog. And you can listen live from there. All of them are archived, over 400 hours of professional filmmakers sharing their expertise with you. And all we ask in return is that you spread the word right now as you listen, and reach out to somebody and have them listen with you through your favorite social media means or email, or there in person at the coffee shop. Say, hey, check this out. And also leave comments at the player or rate and review the podcast when you're listening live. All right, let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Deborah Granick is a director nominated for the Academy Award and co-writer of Winter's Bone, which was nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture, and won the Grand Jury Prize at the 2010 Sundance Film Festival. Granick's first feature film, Down to the Bone, was awarded the Best Director Prize at the 2004 Sundance Film Festival, and she's known for her amazing work with actors and essentially launching the careers of both Vera Farmiga, she's going to kill me with it, and Jennifer Lawrence. Her work is known as an inspiration and collaborative style that she describes as a late-breaking global neorealism. And her most recent offering is the documentary Stray Dog, and it began with a chance encounter while scouting and casting Winter Bone. Granick met Ron Stray Dog Hall in the biker church of Branson and cast him as the estranged father, Thump Milton. Now, of her work, she says, "The question I had for most of my life is, how are you coping? And some people have these small positive schemes for survival, a kind of strength that I'm attracted to, maybe because I'm prone to the blues." Now, in Hall, she found a worthy subject, one whose humor and lack of self-consciousness had the potential to make the plight of the Vietnam vets accessible to a broader audience. So stay tuned. She's coming up right now. Hi, Deborah. How you doing?
Hello.
Rex. Hi, can you hear me?
Hello, I'm good. Yes, I can. I'm good. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Welcome to the show. I'm
great.
So glad that you're here. Are you on the East Coast right now?
I am. I'm sitting in an office in Poughkeepsie, New York, on the college campus of Vassar College.
Well, very cool. But in a couple of days, you're going to be here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and you're going to be attending the Milwaukee Film Festival, and you're accompanying your film, Stray Dog.
That's right.
Can you tell us? I read some introduction, you know, that you met this gentleman, when casting Winterbone, and you cast him as the father. What is Stray Dog about as a documentary film?
Stray Dog is about life in contemporary America as seen through the eyes of sort of one family. It's a family in southern Missouri. Ron Stray Dog Hall is a man, as you said, I did meet through a prior project. And I, in sort of learning a little bit more about his life, realized that his life, like all of our lives, you know, somehow is woven to a bunch of themes that are much, very much here and now, vital, and things that, unless you sort of walk in someone else's shoes, you don't always know about. You don't always know sort of the details of the picture. And Ron was someone who was willing to sort of talk about and show some of those details, what made, you know, where he came of age, how he's formed himself as an American over the last couple decades, what would have been the biggest influences, what are his biggest concerns, those kind of issues, that kind of meat of an existence. And when someone's willing to not just divulge, but more like share some of that, you realize that there are a lot of points of intersection with your own life. And you realize that Ron's one of many, you know, so it's never about looking for, you know, uniqueness as a goal. It's about the way individuals we share a lot with each other, you know, that we have a lot of commonality. And so it's a difficult film in that sense, because it's not about anything that you can just, you know, Ron's not in a contest. You know, Ron isn't, you know, going to become a public speaker about PTSD. It's not like he's going to become a celebrity or win something, or he's not going to climb Everest. You know, it's more that he is going to try to navigate his life, and has been, and then he's going to talk about how he does it.
It's fascinating. Now, in light of the introduction with the notion that some people have coping skills, or that they run their life differently, was there something about Ron that you noticed in meeting him that drew you to him?
Many things. I mean, many things. Just he's a very, you know, for me, he's a very photogenic individual, in the sense that he's often, when affiliated with his biking, you know, he's in full motorcycle, you know, in leather, and he's a burly individual, so has a striking presence. You know, he takes up room. He has a tattoo that means a lot and directly relates to his own history, which is, you know, has the word Vietnam on his arm. And I didn't expect to see that word or mention of that country sitting, you know, in a really small town in southern Missouri. That was not a word I expected to glance over to the man next to me on a pew in a church, a biker's church, no less, and see that word. It made me want to speak to him. But then when I finally got to his home turf where he lived, he greeted me with four small dogs in his arms, really small dogs. And I was like, God, you know, I already had just, if you had a dog, I would have assumed you had a big dog. And I would have assumed maybe that your dog was somehow fierce in some way, or maybe possibly even, you know, intimidating in some way. And, you know, so one of his opening lines to me is like, yeah, a lot of the guys from my generation, a lot of Vietnam-era men have really small dogs. I'm like, Already, anthropology, you know, as an American, as a fellow American, he's just put out a piece of anthropological material that I certainly didn't know about. And I immediately, it piqued my interest. I'm like, I want to know the why and how of that. I want to know why that is, and what are your thoughts on that? And he's a very eloquent person. He's very articulate person. So he, over the course of the ensuing conversations that I would have with him for the next 3 years, he was really able to talk about that and show me how true it was, you know. And that one of the more touching things I will never be able to get on screen, because it happened before I met him, was that was even his sort of route to seeking help very late in his life to deal with some issues related to PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Where a bunch of vets coming through trying to stop at his RV park. They were traveling, and they all had small dogs. And they recognized in him. They said, dude, you know, there's some stuff that you have in your life, some things we're picking up on, some things you've said, and we've had some of that stuff. You got to get yourself, you got to find a decent therapist at the VA, and you've got to see if you can get a little bit of discussion going, see if you can actually receive some kind of meaningful therapy And he said the only people he would have ever listened to would be other vets. You know, that could have gone in one ear and out the other if anyone else had said that to him. Would have been, frankly, very unwelcome, I think, as a comment or a suggestion. But the fact that, and one of the reasons that they saw their commonality was the small dogs. I mean, that it's almost like a speaking stone. You know, these guys that maybe find it hard to talk about emotions and stuff that isn't going well in their lives, with a small dog under their arm, it's possible. For some, you know,
Well, that's an interesting thing, because it suggests a couple of things to me as I listen to you speak. The notion that they have rapport because of the small dogs, that there's this commonality or this that connects them, and then the idea that it's a small dog as opposed to, you know, a mastiff or a Rottweiler. I mean, it's something more maybe genteel or it's tiny, you know, requiring more care.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
You know, so
the care
so
part,
that
the care,
way that
yeah.
the way they approach their life, you know, with care. Well, let me backtrack. I wanted to tie something together. You correct me if or make an observation. You were nominated for 4 Academy Awards for Winter's Bone, which is an amazing movie, and it's very story-driven and very character-driven and very performance-driven. I mean, those are the things that truly stand out. It's not devoid of action, but it's not an action picture. I don't know quite how to put it. It's more conversational than it is active in my mind, but it's riveting and it is compelling. And the thing that makes it so is your work with the characters in the story, the bringing these people to life and the performances as the actors have, lived these characters. And so it touched, I think, many people. It obviously touched the Academy voters. And it's fair to say that it launched Jennifer Lawrence's career, I would imagine. So I would imagine that kind of care and attention, the perspective that you have in dealing with people on the set and bringing a story to life, while it's a different approach in documentary filmmaking, to let the character, not the characters, but the people, the subjects unfold, I would imagine that the care that you have as a director, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you bring to the documentary process without interfering with it, if I made any sense at all in that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what's interesting is that certain, you know, it's probably not surprising then, hearing you say these comments and me trying to, you know, process that, that I picked a very character-driven, you know, scenario in which to turn a more documentary approach, right, which is, you know, when he's a very, very developed character, you know, he's the kind of character that would leap from the pages of a book, like Daniel Woodrell describing Teardrop, the uncle in mm-hmm. Winter's Bone, who was played by John Hawkes. And Ron is Ron's good friend Whitey is a super colorful character. Ron's neighbor Bobby is a colorful character. But they came, you know, in a documentary, what's crazy is they come obviously fully dressed. They come with their teeth, without their teeth. They come with their dogs. They come with housing, a set that's already developed. You know, each one of those individuals lives in a very specific kind of RV that has been decorated very specifically, has objects pertaining to their lives, cooks in a certain way, cooks for their dog in a certain way. Some of them have children, some of them don't. Some of them have, you know, really extreme financial straits, some don't. But so what I'm trying to say is that all that I love about trying to bring a narrative to life in a documentary, often it's very much given to you. And you just have to be a very disciplined observer, recorder. It's almost more about your stamina to some extent. It's your stamina of, like, sticking to it, showing up day after day or week after week, following and striking out a lot. Some events aren't interesting. Some events are weird. Some events are unpredictable. But if you film enough of them, eventually you're going to have quite a bit of gems, you know. Or you know, and sometimes I think I'm a nutter. You know, it's like there's one scene that's not in the film that I loved, but for me it was the anthropology of how men organize a potluck. You know, I've never been a fly on the wall of sort of how men alone do things, you know. And this was a biker group that was going to do a chili supper. And it's like, you know, I don't know, just seeing a biker say, who's going to bring the onions? I don't know why that slayed me. You know, I was like, oh, God, have I died and gone to heaven? You know, it's like, you know, simple line, but I guess it was just sort of the unexpected nature of it. You know, seeing, you know, I don't know what it was, the care about the chili dinner. I don't know whether seeing people be real meticulous about details made me think more of a kind of more vanilla organization or a more female concern with detail. I don't know what stereotypes I was defying for myself, but, you know, so, you know, I think what makes you crazy about a documentary is that you end up with 300 scenes. When you go with a narrative script, you know you've got 120 scenes, you've got 24 days, and you're not going to be adding scenes, you know? With a documentary, you might get 300 scenes, and 90 of them can fit in a film that people can watch, unless you do a series, you know?
Right. Well, go ahead, I'm sorry. No, please, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, and the temptation was to actually do a series, not because we think everything we, you know, it's not like everything we do is so holy or, you know, everything we do is good. It's every scene. All I mean was that there was enough material, like, you know, what if it was like an hour of just from the perspective of the teenage twins, you know, an hour from the neighbor, an hour from Ron himself, an hour for Ron's best friend Whitey, you know, what would happen if we actually sort of did a long form weird documentary, kind of a novel style, you know, somehow differentiating that from reality TV. But in some ways we really weren't prepared, you know, we weren't prepared to sort of stay with the project that long, you know, in that sense. It's like we love, but there's a lot of pressure in one's life to sort of also try other things. So it's like, it's interesting how you have to sort of parse your energy.
So you said 3 years. So from the moment that you met him, when did you then come back? How did you approach the topic with Ron? Say, hey, I would like to, you know, capture you on film, and how did you negotiate that with the subject? And then, you cast him in the movie. So, but from there, how did it unfold? You then did A Winter's Bone, and at some point during or after you undertook the documentary?
Right. So in wrapping up, the first time I sort of ever met Ron in his own home base was like the day we were going to leave Missouri. The crew had gone home from Winter's Bone, and we had really wrapped up. We had returned rentals. Things were done. Move our paperwork out of the office or the hotel room or whatever we were staying in. And you know, learn quite a bit about Ron. And then actually the first follow-up with him was we were going to do a little piece that was going to be like almost like a DVD extra. I think it turns out that it was something that we were able to put up, you know, on the internet. It was a piece called Hillbilly Up. And this was a piece to deconstruct the word hillbilly, just to really look at it, really scour that word, have people who identify, self-report as hillbillies from the region, from the Ozarks, discuss this word in depth. And Ron participated in that, and I could tell that he was actually a really very articulate person who had a really down-home, accessible way to explain his feelings to people. And at that point, I believe I said, Ron, you know, crazy it seems, like maybe we... What would you think if we ever came back and sort of tried to do a project with you where we chronicle some of your daily life? He had told me that he takes this cross-country ride with other Vietnam vets. It's a very sort of well-known annual ritual event in which the riders traverse the country and go to the Vietnam Memorial in D.C., the wall. I was like, you know, I'm thinking we chronicle some parts of your daily life. We follow you to Washington. You know, we ride with the riders. We're right behind them, you know. And he's like, girl, I'm up for it. You know, I'm game. And you know, we'll talk logistics if you know, because I was like, there is some serious logistics here. You'd have to, you know, help us get permission from, you know, some of the other people that attend that ride so that, you know, that they would feel okay about us being present. And So he helped us work that side of it. So it seemed doable because he was accessible. And many famous documentary makers that we all revere will say that. What's one of the preconditions for any documentary to ever even get started? It's access to the human, to the person. And that's a line that Barbara Koppel will often say, you know, publicly, that access. You know, when people say, how did you live with those strikers in the meat? Was that in Wisconsin? I forget what state the big meat strike was in that she chronicled.
I don't know. That's a good question.
So people, how did you sit in the kitchen with that striking meat packer, you know, and who was on strike for 8 weeks, and you know, and you were there, and he spoke and he revealed a lot of his emotions, and she's like, access, you know, I was given the word and the sign that people were okay with me being there, that they knew I was very dedicated to chronicling this over time, and they were that, you know, that I was very much on their side of the strikers, you know, and by that time they were used to me and access had been granted. And Ron was someone who was giving me that sign that, yes, I will tolerate your presence, and I don't exactly know what you're after and why you're doing this, so there's also a huge amount of trust. But then, of course, that trust weighs very heavily on the filmmaker, you know. Then it's on me to not betray that trust, you know. But, you know, you have to come clean with yourself. You know, I'm not looking for dirt on Ron. I'm not looking to, like, expose some dark side of someone, or I'm not looking and hoping that, oh, man, I hope at the end of the day that he's actually really in a militia and that, you know, his scene is really salacious and scary and effed up, you know. But that's not what I was looking for. I was looking for a person who has a lot of different views from me, different from the views I hold, a lifestyle that's very different from my own, who is willing to talk to me and who is willing to give insights about what it's like to sort of be him. And so I think, you know, that was the next step when you ask about the steps to sort of meeting him, to making the film. And then soon after that, the actual ride to D.C. was upon us. And so we came down to, again, started with him from the get-go of the ride. And then it was very hard to keep up with that, such a huge motorcycle convoy for that many days. That was probably the hardest part of our shooting process.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I was going to say it's a very disciplined operation. It's sort of like a military maneuver because the participants are hugely trained people who have had real life experience. And, you know, here we are, you know, filmmakers who have never done a precise maneuver, like, you know, and it was like, oh, dark 30 was the wake-up time, you know, and the whole thing was arduous. It was really arduous. And for many of them, that's something that they also seek. They seek that, not just the exhilaration, but the intensity of, like, what it means to, like, apply yourself 100% to something.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, and there's, you know, with a feature film or a short film or any type of film or television project, there's an end in sight. You have a story, you know what your beginning, middle, and end is, and arcs. It's done. You can pack up and go home. And with a documentary, you are either on a beck and call or at the whim of the subject or the whim of the filmmaker. I mean, it doesn't have that same necessary schedule to it, unless somebody says, well, we're going to go into that town, we're going to be there for a week, and then we're done. So over a three-year period, you know, you've gotten to know Ron and the people he surrounds himself with and some of what he does. I'm going to guess, but it's almost like your life isn't your own at that point because you would either come or go or you interact. I mean, it's quite different than narrative filmmaking.
It's very different, and you're so right about the sort of back and call, the whim, the vicissitudes. Like, it's not that like Ron would demand that we show up, but more like you're right that we didn't want to miss stuff. And so we actually had to get some colleagues. We needed to bond and make you know, meaningful relationship with some Missouri-based shooters so that when we couldn't be there, there were many events that would happen very spontaneously. And if I had weekly calls or sometimes, you know, several times a week calls with Ron, and I would inventory him, just ask him, when is the next time that, you know, the Freedom of the Road Riders are going to meet, or when is the next time that you're going to be, or he would tell me maybe there's a big event, like his granddaughter is having a baby, or, you know, something that was a life, you know, a family event, or and so then I had to plan with my team, you know, when could we go to Missouri, when could we be there physically and film at long stretches, and when could we have a local crew observe and record local events, and that's how we had to do it, because we couldn't be there. You're absolutely right, unless that's one reason to shoot local. Lots of reasons to do lots of things local these days, and definitely jet fuel and accessibility
right.
is a reason. And yet it really confines us, because sometimes you're just specifically interested in someone from Wisconsin or Missouri, or just because you don't live there, because you don't know it, you know. So
sure.
You have to balance that, I think. But yeah, the vicissitudes, it's like a sheet of, you know, it's like being like whipped around. Yeah, it's so true. You're whipped around by this project where you want wonderful things to happen and spontaneous things, and yet half the time you're saying like, oh, gosh, you know, how can we do this? How can we get down there, you know? And sometimes we'd have to beg him to like, wait up for us. Like, we'd be like, don't go down to Mexico yet, you know? Wait, we're coming. You know, and then he and Alicia, that's his partner who's Mexican, who enters the story midway, they did a lot of filming themselves, which was also stupendous. It was, you know, in the end, we had to be careful about how many different formats we had in terms of what the film looked like. I don't mean because it's
sure,
precious,
sure.
But because it can get...
Right.
Actually, because unfortunately, unless it's like a archival film... You know, people are now used to thinking that, oh, it means something very differently when you switch formats. Sometimes it's the practical nature of it, and sometimes people want to, you know, they're inclined to read an aesthetic or a sort of a significance in it. But the fact is, we had to be very creative about how we would get different kinds of coverage, because we could not be there all the time, and we had to be strategic when we would come down and then stay for a while. You know, we would have to stay for... at a minimum a week because of the fact that it takes a lot to get there. And we also wanted to shoot a lot. I mean, what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, when we were there, we really had to push hard. We had to exploit the moments of each day because it felt very valuable to be in person.
Well, you know, it's tough enough to schedule a narrative shoot, a feature film, to do it within a certain block of time and to get everything that you need done and to be satisfied as a filmmaker that you've captured what you wanted to capture and you're telling the story that you wanted to tell. And now, you know, you're doing a documentary where sometimes you have to arrange for however many of your team to take off from wherever they are and then travel back to, you know, another location and to reassemble and to capture whatever you need to capture and then have those same kinds of, did I get what I wanted? Am I hoping, you know, I'm capturing what's going on? And then to leave and then come back and do it all over again when something else transpires. It's an, you know, I think just an enormous responsibility and a commitment and a sense of dedication that must transcend all of it in order, I mean, you really want to have to tell the story in order to put yourself through all of that.
No, it's so true. And, you know, you can get cold feet, you know, but I think the fact is, I mean, you can get cold feet, like, what is this going to add up to? What, you know, especially when there isn't, like we talked about, if there's not a real specific arc, you can feel really lost. You can feel like, will this add up? And yet sometimes just the fact that you enjoyed witnessing the scene or that the filming, like you liked what you saw through the viewfinder, or when you bring it home and you're like, gosh, you know, for whatever reason, I'm just really touched by the scene of the three guys hanging out, drinking a cup of coffee together. You know, I love their banter. I like the way they relate to each other. You know, I like their humor. And at some point, you know, this is a moment I think a lot of filmmakers wait for, which is like when you know that you're enjoying it, when you know you're seeing something that you would actually just like to see even in another person's film. You know, it's like that's when you get the second wind to say like, okay, this feels really out of control, and this is really an accumulation of motley footage, but I want to keep forging. I want to see this through. I want to see what portrait we can actually sculpt.
Oh, that's very cool. I'm gonna take a break right now, Deborah, just so you know. I want to make a couple of announcements about you and the film and other things, and then we'll come back and we'll continue that, because it is, you know, where do you get the story from the footage? You've got the story that's there, and have you captured it on film? I'll take this break and just hang right there, and we'll be back. You're listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat. My guest today is Deborah Granick, the director of Stray Dog, the movie. .com. StrayDogTheMovie.com is the website. The documentary film is Stray Dog. She, Deborah, and the film will be at the Milwaukee Film Festival this coming weekend. It's actually going to be there Saturday, the 27th, at the Downer Theater in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And, I'm sorry, yes, I take that back. Hold on a second. It'll be at the Oriental Theater September 27th and the 29th. It will be at the Times. So it's going to be in different places in Milwaukee. I'm messing this up. But you're going to be in attendance, and it says that Tori Stewart, co-producer, will be in attendance, I believe, and Ron Stray Dog Hall himself is going to be there, the film subject, Freddie Strickland, a film subject, and Robin Smith. These are people from your documentary who will all be in attendance on the 27th at the Oriental Theater, September 29th. This is 4:15 at the Times. So that's coming up. And again, it's StrayDogTheMovie.com. You can go and you can read about it there and Deborah's work. Also, on the 27th at 11:30 a.m. at the Downer Theater will be Winter's Bone, the feature film we discussed earlier that was nominated for 4 Academy Awards. And then Working with Actors, September 27th, the very same day at 2:30 p.m. at Collectivo on Prospect, Deborah will present on this topic about working with actors. Then that one is, all of these excite me, but I also definitely want to be there and see you working, you know, discussing working with actors live. So it's a great day. It's Saturday the 27th. It's coming up. It's this weekend. If you're in the listening area, you can get your tickets online. It's Milwaukee Film Festival. You're going to want to do that. You go see StrayDogTheMovie.com. And also, you can find out more at RexSykesMovieBeat.me, where we have an article up. It's a blog, but we've got the you can read about my guest and the different events and go from there. So my next guest will be Thursday the 25th. That is the opening day of the festival, and it's director Gil Cates Jr. He also will be in attendance at October 9th with his movie The Surface, which shot in Milwaukee with Sean Astin and Chris Mulkey and others, Mimi Rogers and others. And so he's my next guest Thursday morning, 11 a.m. Eastern time. And then after that, coming up, we will continue with the writer's series with Michael Frost Beckner and others. And Peter Marshall will be back with the director's series and different things that we're doing on Rex Sykes Movie Beat. And I invite you to stay tuned and to help spread the word. And with that, we're going to go back to Deborah. I'm enjoying this conversation very much. I mean, it's very interesting. It's very fascinating. You found this person, you know, obviously who captivated you, but you had done Winter's Bone, and you had done a narrative feature or more, and now you turn to documentary film, and you've shot a lot of footage, and now you have to edit, and from that, you know, there's a story, but you hope you've captured it, or does the story come from what you've captured? I mean, in other words, it's how do you let the documentary unfold, or how do you make the documentary versus how do you make the narrative film? In other words, can you discuss the differences in your responsibilities and obligations to the material as a director in each instance?
Yeah, I think, it's always a hard process to, when you have kind of scenes that deal with different characters and different themes to know, like, if a film can contain, you know, maybe comfortably three themes, you know, maybe themes about veteran identity and issues related to sort of the aftermath of war in the lives of American men in this case, and it can deal with maybe immigration, like what happens if you end up making a strong commitment to, like, live with or get married to someone from another culture, you know, what happens there, and then that's a meaty theme. The first one's a meaty theme, and then maybe you've got room for one more, which is sort of what is it like for Americans living in, you know, very much surviving in poverty, you know, trying to really cling on to life despite the fact that a lot of real hardship goes down around medical care, around teeth, around nutrition, around, you know, and yet what happens when you see almost like an older version of semi-rural America where there is a lot of help, you know. I didn't ever get to film the scene. I'll get back to your question, but I there was a scene that
sure.
a couple of times blew my mind where at the local community center where sometimes there'd be like a little shindig, you know, there'd be like a covered dish event. When someone's house would burn down or when someone had a really serious ailment, that was what the event was for. It was like, it would be like this covered dish event to help raise money for the people that lost their house. You know, same thing. Like, I mean, it was like seeing rent parties from the Depression. You know, it was like where people would get together and try to help raise rent for people. It was, you know, I'm not trying to give a Pollyanna glimpse like, oh, man, semi-rural, poor America. Wow, how charming. They do little events for each other. No, I just meant that, like, oh, my God. It was sobering and touching at the same time. You know, it was sobering that there's just, you know, for many people, there's just zero safety net. And it was touching that sometimes the kindness of neighbors actually kicks in, you know. But, like, you can see that, like, that theme could have been very extensive. That theme could have been the whole film. You know, there could be a series about sort of what it's like to live in poverty right now in America. You know, what are those challenges? What does it really take? What really happens to you, you know? There could be a whole series of and a full-length film about just what it's like to have PTSD, like, many years after the headlines fade, when it's no longer a popular discussion on any kind of AM television, or when it's not a discussion, when it's not in the headlines, you know, when you're just sort of left holding the bag after sort of the headlines fade. So, you know, that is one of the supreme challenges, is, like, how you're going to tease out what you can actually, so to speak, chew off, you know, or include. And I think that's, like, one of the, you know, the hugest difference. But I did slightly lose track of how you were phrasing your question. My tangent took me afar.
Yeah, well, it was probably a long-winded question. It's the difference between being a director on a narrative movie and assembling your footage and editing the story that you know that you have, because, say, in the case of Winter's Bone, you're a co-writer on the script. You know, you went with the intention of creating a movie, and now you've shot it, and you've got to go back and edit it. But with a documentary, you're somewhat open to how the story unfolds, and you're gathering footage as it goes along, and you may have inklings of what story you want to tell, but there might be multiple stories that emerge. So how do you, as a director, you know, go from both as a documentary filmmaker, how does that differ from the narrative process of editing the movie?
You do look for through lines. You look for, like, with the theme relating to Ron's veteran identity and, you know, if you want to call it in some sense, sort of the long cost, the sort of the long cost of war, you know, the fact that that as someone proceeds in their life, for many people that participate in combat, some of the things that happen to them don't go away. And I think that's contrary to what we think, like, oh, 5 to 7 years later, everyone should be okay, you know. And that really isn't what the VA is finding, and that's not what the Vietnam generation found. And so it's not like a short-term effect. That ended up being a through line. You know, one of the young bloods we met on the ride, a very dashing guy who's coming to Milwaukee, you know, we thought he was dashing. You know, it was just like a very well-spoken individual who was also very soulful. You know, he was trying to describe to Ron, sort of from a younger generation perspective, what how he feels combat really altered sort of the way, you know, the way he functions. And that became a through line. So there's Ron talking about this younger soldier, Freddie's talking about it. Then there's the burials. So as these guys are dealing with stuff, you know, more American soldiers are coming back and they're being buried, and a very certain very specific segment of the population is sort of bearing the cost of that loss, and or, you know, that's not everyone participates in combat. It's a very specific quadrant of our population, you know, or demographic, often defined by social class. So, you know, Ron, that theme, one morning Ron said something about that as he was cooking eggs. So you see what I'm saying, the through line started to get built, like Ron, Freddie, a burial, a comment, and there it goes. Then we know that's one of the through lines. That's one of the ways in which this theme is touched on by a variety of people, places, and things. Small dogs maybe is one of the ones that we thought was going to be a major through line. And right now it's not, actually, in the finished product. That sort of more its own film. Honestly, it was almost like there was enough material there for its own film. The surviving, living on very, very limited financial resources is a through line in the film. That's a through line that was touched upon by Ron's granddaughter, by his neighbors. There was a scene that spoke to it really beautifully that didn't make it in, but it was one of those ones we would have put in that through line. It was a scene in which Ron and his sort of right-hand man at the RV park were trying to strategize to purchase a second washing machine, you know, a public washing machine that would be used by the residents of the RV park. And yet, you know, so few people could contribute. You know, the rents weren't covered. You know, there was just no extra funding. You know, there's no extra money, not funding, but money in which to sort of do infrastructure repairs. You know, the desire was there, the vision's there, the know-how is there, but there just isn't the cash flow, really. And so you can see, like, even the most ordinary things start to line up in terms of through lines. And then the art of the editor is just sort of how to make those through lines jive with each other, so that you're watching a film that you're not feeling like, wow, obviously we can't put a through line, even if Ron loved elephants. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm just thinking something, you know, absurd.
Sure.
We probably couldn't develop a through line about why Ron likes elephants. That probably wouldn't have flown. That would have felt like, you know, a really weird off-base tangent. Like, why is that in the film, you know?
So let me ask you a question. What do you think your responsibility is as a documentary filmmaker? It seems that the notion of documentaries has changed. And I wonder if it's changed for the audience as well. It used to be, I think people thought of documentaries as they thought of the news. You know, it was an objective look at some topic. The filmmaker attempted to be invisible and not have a point of view, even though we know that that's impossible. But there was this lip service to, you know, everything was objective, not so subjective. And then Michael Moore came along, and people had said, well, now he's telling his side, and he's doing it as a documentary, and it's not really, you know, whether Michael Moore or anybody, you know, they're not really fair to have a point of view for the filmmaker to insert their opinion into a documentary. But I think documentaries today are more popular than they've ever been, and there's a wider venues open to them or avenues open, and more people are watching documentaries and they're being educated or they're learning about topics that they might not otherwise do. As a filmmaker, how do you fit into that? What do you see as your responsibility? I don't want a philosophical, I'm not trying to ask a philosophical question here, but as the filmmaker, what role do you play in bringing the story? Because I think that's fascinating. You know, you can't tell everything about Ron. So if he really loved elephants, that may not even have come up in this movie. But the other things do. So there are things just because of convention, just because of time, just because of story that will be omitted and other things will be included. So thereby, it is subjective. How do you feel as the filmmaker telling the story? Like, how do you? Is there a different way you would describe yourself as a documentary filmmaker from a narrative filmmaker? Does that make sense?
You're telling stories,
but maybe differently.
Yes, but I was going to say that the first sort of part of your question is extremely timely, and it always is. You know, it's funny, it crops up all the time. It's cropped up, like you say, since the beginning of documentary being talked about. It, you know, there's a whole seminar, as you may know, you know, just that discusses, it bears his name, Flaherty, the Flaherty Seminar, from the documentary filmmaker Robert Flaherty. You know, and the reason why I think they even keep his name, and because he brought up the essential set of questions that we've never, there will be no conclusion, because truth-telling is contingent. What you omit and what you include alter anyone's perception. We know this, you know, there have been radical discussions about exposing jump cuts so you know what was omitted. You know, I can't remember if when Errol Morris, you know, interviews some of these sort of history-changing people, you know, the McNamara. You know, when, you know, whatever is said in between sentences is just as important as, you know, what's said, you know, before and after. So what I'm trying to say is that there is no neutrality. There is no way to be unobtrusive. You can try to be less intrusive. You know, that philosophical debate, by putting a camera in a room, you alter it. Even some people say, you know, just think about this. You alter it, at least molecularly. You know, there's no way that you could ever say that by placing a camera in a setting that you don't somehow alter what might play out there. That being said, of course, there's ways to try to roll back the impact. You know, smaller footprint. You know, if 8 people in a room or 2 people in a room, that makes a big difference. You can try to be there so long that people stop noticing you so much. You know, inurement, the idea that there was some groundbreaking shows in the 70s, right, one where they lived with a family, you know, on television, right? It was like a PBS show where they lived with a family for a while, the crew. There's a wonderful Canadian documentary where they lived with a family for a long time. And, you know, the aftermath of those stories can sometimes be very disturbing, like what happens to the family in real life after the fact that they've been filmed. That's a whole other thing of ethics. It is fraught with responsibilities and ethics. Do most filmmakers think that they can hit that mark of feeling totally clean? No, I don't think so. You know, I think there's much more responsibility about not, like, somehow betraying your documentary subject. Like, it's a pretty low form of life to, like, get people to trust you and then somehow try to, like, show them in a bad light.
Right.
That would not make me feel good as a filmmaker. And, you know, I'm using two beautiful quotes I heard super recently from the filmmaker, sort of an American treasure, the filmmaker Albert Maisel, the documentary filmmaker. And he said two things that really seared into me. One is, the art of documentary is to get close, but not so close as to hurt. I thought that was very well said.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing he said is, my mission, he's speaking for himself, my mission as a documentary filmmaker, what I feel like is my life's work, is to attempt to rehumanize, you know, to humanize, to take a person, a place, a thing, an event, a side, a political faction, something that's possibly been dehumanized, and try to show the human, you know, try to humanize it. You know, that means when we think we have an enemy or an opponent, you know, that the attempt sometimes is to show enough detail of their lives so that they have become humanized in your brain. You know, you understand their humanity. And he gave a wonderful example, which was kind of speaks to responsibility, which is he had growing up, there was like ethnic strife where he grew up in Boston. I guess like sometimes like Jewish kids and Irish kids didn't get along sometimes in a certain neighborhood. And he was talking about the fact that he'd always been scared of the Irish kids that lived down the street. And one time it came to blows and there was some kind of street fight. And a couple years later, he found out that some of the Irish guys he had grown up were involved in Bible sales. And he got in contact with them, asked if he could ask the Bible company. It was like kind of like lateral sales, whether he could film them. The company said yes. The guys said yes. And he and his brother ended up spending like 6 weeks on the road with these Irish guys that they had grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole film is in service to sort of humanizing what it's like to try to eke out a living in 1966 as a door-to-door salesman and how brutal that can be.
Wow.
And how, you know, and he truly humanizes it. Like, you would just sort of, at that point, probably seeing that film, you'd never want to just slam the door in a door-to-deal. You know, we don't have that same kind of thing anymore, but I'm just saying,
right.
You know, it was so much showing their humanity, showing how anxious they were about the quota, how their lifestyle was really marginal because they were eking out a living, like getting blood from a turnip, you know, and
right.
You know, so you know, I was just so touched by that, like the history and the context of sort of what he thinks is a responsibility of a documentary filmmaker, you know. You know, obviously there's also a trend to, like, go for the salacious, go for the juggler, go for the humiliation, go for the,
right.
You know, that reality TV sort of brought us down to sort of a bottom-feeding level sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I do try to separate myself from that, not to try to be elitist, but try to, like, shit, that's just not what I want to do. You know,
right.
I don't want to be getting off on finding people that are in difficult situations and sort of like, you know, celebrating the ability to look their rewards.
I hear you completely. Right. No, I hear
you.
I hear you completely. Well, it seems to make, it seems to me some of it can be understood, you know, by marketing. I mean, if somebody said, if a filmmaker said, you know, I really tried to stay independent of my topic, and I'm really trying to examine both sides, say, of a political format. I'm trying to look at the right and the left and let you decide, and how well have I done, you know, because I'm trying to give both sides without my point of view. I think that's fair, and if somebody says that and they can stick to it and they can do that to whatever degree, great. If somebody else comes along and says, you know what, I like the right better than the left, so here's my view on it. As long as they're open, or I like the left better than the right, as long as they kind of admit to what they're doing, I don't have a problem with that. You know, it's because it allows people to go and see it for what it is, or at least what the filmmaker's statement about it is. I think it's a fascinating thing that what documentaries do and what it sounds like you have done is it opens us up to the opportunity to see people being people, experience them as human, get a taste or a feel for a lifestyle that may not be ours, or even problems or issues that people encounter that make us human, and to better understand the humans we live with. It sounds more like something that brings us together than that would divide or separate, going along with what you said a moment ago about, you know, we can go to the baser facts, you know, or the baser areas and do that, but that's not something you want to do. You know, the responsibility of filmmakers, whatever they decide it is, but the idea that, you know, we're all in this, you know, this fishbowl together, and if somebody can shed a light on something that makes us understand our humanity a little bit more, well, then I think it's probably a good thing. I'm sorry, that wasn't even a question. That was just a statement.
Yeah, no,
but,
No. I do too. I do too. And I think, but no matter what, there's going to be stuff that comes up. You know,
yes.
In this particular subject, I was working, you know, with Ron and his people. You know, there were issues that were complicated. There were issues that really were disturbing to me, and I filmed some of them, and then, you know, but without doing a more replete job, it would have actually been like, in some ways, I think, very incendiary and very sensational for me to put them in. You know, very different protocols and feelings and relationship to firearms, for example, you know. exist in the community where I happen to be filming,
uh-huh.
as it exists in many, many, many parts of the country. And then, you know, there's some things that really are very both alienating to me and concerning to me. And again, but without a really, you know, without going full tilt on that subject, I actually think it was a disservice to include them, because you need, they need really long time. They need, that really needs to be explored in depth. You put in something that could be sensational, like a kind of firearm that maybe isn't entirely legal or whatever, possessed by someone in that community, or a lot of them, or, you know I'm not talking, you know, it's funny that we could show a gun show, you know, where so many guns are in one room or in one basketball court of the local high school or wherever it is, you know, but then that might be the right context in which, you know, to talk about it, because the whole film would be trying to look at, you know, what's our nation's relationships to firearms in 2014. You know, that would be the right context, I think, to go deep. You know, and so all I'm trying to say is that if you can't sort of really go deep into something or try to at least show something full about it, it becomes another kind of weird, I think, irresponsibility to sort of just pop it in because you could, because I got it on film. You know, that's, you know what I mean? And
Yeah.
But I also think one interesting thing, what, you know, based on the comment you were making, is that it's also this very difficult concept for us, especially in American culture, about the and. That somebody can be this, and something else. That someone can, we really are much more comfortable with black and white distinctions. We really are. We are one of those cultures that really is so much more comfortable. And documentary often is like this, it's almost like a torture. It's like wearing a hirsute coat or something, because it brings up the and all the time.
That's a really,
you know,
good,
it's like
point.
It's like being sprayed with itching powder, you know, because documentaries show us that it's rarely black and white, and how that kind of wrecks our understanding of, like, getting our firm opinions about things.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. It's a captivating point. You know, I used to say, don't define me by what I do, because I do many things. This might be my career, but this might be my passion. This might be my family. This might be my genetics. This may be my nationality. You know, we are all many, many different things, and yet people will pick and go, well, you're a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or you're a professional, you know, you're an orthodontist. That's, you know, and they peg you by you. So the notion of what you said about black and white, the documentaries, or in this case, like the story you're telling, it has that and tag. There's more to the person than that easy, you know, peg to put on them, and that makes them most captivating and maybe sometimes frustrating, because we have to face not settling for black and white when it raises that additional element that we're out of our comfort zone when we're watching some of that. If I understood you right, that's a really fascinating point for me to consider.
Yeah, I think, and it's a headbanger when you're who among us also wouldn't want it to be sometimes more black and white. Like, you know, it's hard when you really like someone and then they have a political view that you don't share. You know, we know that's hard. It's hard in our own families, right? And occasionally that was like, you know, occasionally those were moments where I felt, you know, I did experience like a personal disconcerting feeling, like, God, I like you so much, and yet I don't share your view on this, or I can't understand why you feel this way, you know? But those are sometimes those discomforts that we have to learn to live with. I mean, and yet, of course, you don't want to be a dish rag. You don't want to, like, capitulate just because, you know, I need to leave a project sort of having my core values still intact, you know?
Right. That's a good point.
Doesn't mean they can't be influenced. It doesn't mean they cannot be influenced. It means that I don't need to forsake myself to sort of, you know, think that, oh gosh, I'll be more understood, or I'll be more liked here in Southern Missouri if I give up that opinion or this opinion, you know. And sometimes I felt, you know, really concerned, that I felt like sometimes anger gets really misplaced sometimes, you know, like, God, you know, that certain people in politics get blamed or something when it's really a, such a much more complicated systemic, you know, and sometimes that felt frustrating, you know, that to hear some views that, like, I was like, oh, no, guys, you know, I'm seeing it differently, you know, and noting that maybe my point of view could never really get across, like, that for whatever reason, there would be these places of chasm that can't be crossed, you know?
Well, it's an immense food for thought, and again, it goes back to, you know, the sensitivity or the ethics of the filmmaker and yourself in telling this story or letting this story come to film. I have technically an important question to ask you because we're really at the end of the hour mark, and I know that you're busy, I'm enjoying this so much. If you have a few more minutes, we can continue. If not, either way, I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, well, I can talk maybe a few more minutes, and then I actually have to go. And the reason I'm at this Vassar College today, which I'm actually going to be doing a seminar here, so I do have to pop off in a few minutes.
You got
to
go.
But I can certainly, we can maybe think of one last way to sort of round out our conversation for now.
That would be fantastic. And then at your convenience another time, I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about other topics and Winter's Bone and the success of your recent efforts and filmmaking in general. But let me ask you this, because you are going to be in Milwaukee. You do have the documentary and the special guests. And so, again, remember the website is straydogthemovie.com, and you're going to want to go check that out. You also can go to the Milwaukee Film Festival if I don't have the website right in front of me, and I should, but it's the Milwaukee Film Festival, and you can find that on Google, and you can find out that Deborah will be there the 27th, that's this coming Saturday, morning, noon, and night, essentially. You've got Winter's Bone showing, you've got Stray Dog showing in the evening, you've got a symposium in the afternoon working with actors, and that's the question I'd like to leave this with at this moment, and at least to open up the thing, and that is you're working with live humans in a documentary setting, but you're also, when you're doing a narrative, and I have one question that somebody wanted me to ask you, but you're working in the narrative, you're working with actors, both require trust. One is to help an actor bring life to their character as written and as they understand it, and the other is to allow themselves to be, maybe in both cases, allow them to be themselves when they're in front of the camera and those documentary subjects. The psychology of working with people, do you find that it differs much from helping an actor perform or helping a documentary subject be at ease with you and what you're doing? I imagine they both require trust.
Oh, they do. They do. I think one thing with narrative is that, you know, the actor and the director really are in service to the same thing. I mean, they both want a performance that will hopefully really sing out and be compelling. And, you know, I think one way that I have learned to sort of hopefully cultivate some of that trust is that, you know, I also really respect the actor's instincts. I really like to listen. I'm not a dominator. I don't say, you know, that was terrible. That's completely opposite of what I would like you to do. You know, that's not going to come out of my mouth because I want to see what the actor's bringing first and foremost. And then I might try to, you know, make adjustments, but I'm also going to place a great value on what the actor who spent some time imagining the role and imagining what it would be like to be in the character's shoes. They've invoked their imagination, and they're also using some of their life experience, you know. That was one of the huge joys of working with Vera Farmiga in the earlier film, was that, you know, there was some ways in which she was bringing some real life experience that she had. Not that the film has one of the subjects is a person who's trying to get clean and sober. So it wasn't so much on the on that level as the level of not knowing what to do sort of in the face of your kids watching you go through something very difficult. You know, she just brought some really rich life experiences that could be factored in. So it was like Vera plus the character. And at that point, I've got very little that I'm going to be imputing. I'm going to be sort of tailoring and gently sculpting and trying different variations, especially for the editing room, but I'm not going to be tearing down something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the trust is that she knows I'm going to try to look for variations, and my trust is that she's really immersed and she's really focused on and she's really involved in the scene, that she's believing the fiction of the scene and she's there and she's trying to work it, you know. So I think trust is definitely a huge factor in both relationships. I mean, and you know, I think, you know, it's awkward because it's like on one level, you know, I don't want to necessarily have an actor constantly say, you know, I want to look at myself. They have to trust that I, you know, I'm not going to let them look bad. You know, I'm watching for that. I've got their backs, you know, and then I have to hope that they can trust that I'm really on it, that I'm doing it, that I'm there for them. So it's a huge trust factor, and with Doc, it's probably even more because in Doc, you know, you're wearing your own clothes, you know, that is your real house, that is your real family, and you know, the documentary, you know, it's taking that to the next level, really.
Wow. Well, having done, let me wrap it up with this question, and you may not give as long an answer as you would like, and we can cover that another time, but having done both documentary and narrative, do you have a preference?
You know, I don't. I feel like it leaves me in this really strange, I don't know how a person with more Eastern sensibilities, you know, like more ability to sort of like calm down and be more meditative, but like they just ricochet in my head all the time and they are so inextricably linked. You know, I love the way that you can start a documentary without a lot of bells and whistles, like that you can sort of just try your hand at it and see if the subject is going to work and test it and then proceed incrementally. And with narrative, I love that you can orchestrate things, that you can say like, God, I think it would be really fun to, you know, either recreate or, you know, if I want to do a scene at a county fair, you know, I remembered like that there was a girl that I had seen the year before with her goat. I could try to ask the 4-H club, who was that girl with the goat? Can we bring her? You know, you can orchestrate. You know, you can say like, I thought that girl with the red hair and the goat was so amazing. Can we find her? Can she come in and even though she's not in the fair this year, could we bring her in for the scene? You know. So you get what I mean. Like sometimes you can like cherry pick your favorite things that you've seen or felt or done, and you get to actually ask for them. You're not, you overtly without any shame say like, let's try this, let's bring this in, let's set it here, let's see if we can rent this place, you know. So on some level, it's more of like a candy shop on some level, but then on another level, it's so complicated that real life is a candy shop. Someone's real figurines on their real mantle is the candy shop. So. I don't know. You can see where I get really a little bit. I get hung up. I get in a web that I can't get out of loving both and having them inform each other.
Wow.
But you know,
well,
this is the statement you'll hear out of a lot of filmmakers' mouths, right?
Yeah.
Life is stranger than fiction. So sometimes that's the queen. That's the queen that you all have to pay. We all have to pay homage to. You know, it's like. That life will deal you these characters that you could not have conceived of, but a good novel will do the same. So it's like again, it's I would call it a dialectic. They talk to each other, you know. Yeah.
No, that's very cool, and it's been really, really marvelous that you've been able to make time in your busy day. And be with us here at Rex Sykes Movie Beat. I really do appreciate it, and I'm looking so forward to you being in town on Saturday, the 27th, to attend with your movie and to conduct the symposium and to have Winter's Bone and your special guests, Ron, and others with you. So thanks so much for your time, and enjoy all of your time until then and then beyond that, of course. But I thank you, and I'll call you in a second just to wrap it up off the air. But thank you so much, and have a great rest of the day.
All right. Well, thank you so very much, and I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks. Bye, Deborah.
Bye. Bye.
Deborah Granick, everybody. Very, very fascinating conversation about documentary film and the film Stray Dog. You can find out more about it at RexSykesMovieBeat.me regarding Deborah and her film Winter's Bone and others and Stray Dog and her schedule at the Milwaukee Film Festival. That's RexSykesMovieBeat.me. That's the new blog, or RexSykes.com. There's a page there at the official website, but also at StrayDogTheMovie.com, which is the website for her documentary film. So be sure to read and then to listen, and if you can, attend the movies here at the Milwaukee Film Festival in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Begins the 25th of October, goes till the 9th of the 25th of September, goes to the 9th of October. My next guest is Gil Cates Jr. He's the director of The Surface, a film shot entirely on Lake Michigan in Milwaukee, starring Sean Astin, Chris Mulkey, Mimi Rogers, and more. And you're going to want to listen to what Gil has to say. He's also the co-producer on the recent movie Jobs, about Steve Jobs. And you're going to want to hear what he has to say. It's coming up live, 11 a.m. on Thursday, that's Eastern Time, the 25th, 10 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Pacific. You can join us live. Whenever the show is live, you can join us in the chat room, or you can simply listen. When it's archived, all shows are archived. The same, very same link you use to listen live, you can use to listen to the archive show. And they're archived immediately, and they're available 24/7. And since everybody is giving usually valuable tips and advice and suggestions for you to be able to enhance your career or book another acting role or edit a film a little bit better or shoot at another angle or whatever it is in terms of filmmaking, please help spread the word about my guest by using your favorite social media means or email or phone or in person to talk about the show, talk about Rex Sykes Movie Beat and his guests, because they are golden, and you're going to want to listen to each and every one of them. There's over 400 hours of filmmakers sharing their expertise with you. My next guest is Gil Cates Jr. We're going to have Peter Marshall coming back. We're going to have Michael Frost Beckner coming back, and a whole lot more. So, again, I want to thank my fascinating guest, Academy Award-nominated director Deborah Granick, and you, the readers and listeners of Movie Beat. You can follow me on Twitter at Rex Sykes Movie BT. That last word is abbreviated. You can also find the Friends page on Facebook, Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends. All right, everybody, have a fabulous day. Make your movies, complete your projects, and until we meet the next time, that is a wrap.